It's been a pleasure being here as always. This is usually my favorite conference of the year. And it's been a lot of fun and really is amazing just what a community is. Want to thank the organizers for giving me the chance to give a talk. So it's the last talk of the conference, and it's Friday, and probably everyone's kind of tired. So try and keep it lively and informal, and we'll see how much I get through. There will be some. It's a bootstrap talk, so maybe a little technical. Hopefully, not too technical. The stuff I want to discuss. Let me just mention my collaborators, Kuo Wei Wong. He's a postdoc at Boston University, and Dalyang Li, postdoc at Harvard. And I'll be talking about these two papers we wrote recently. And I also wanted to mention there was another paper came out around the same time as the second one by these people, like CZ and Parnachev, doing similar things to what we did in the second one. Hopefully I'll have time to get to that. But let me start by just saying what the goal is. And the goal is pretty simple to understand. What we want to do is we're going to try and generalize Virasoro conformal blocks to greater than two dimensions. All right? And we'll see how far we can go with this. And we're going to use holography for some guidance, OK? But I'll talk a little bit about what Virasoro, in particular in the context of ADS3 gravity, what Virasoro blocks have taught us, and so why trying to understand them in higher dimensions might be something which could teach us about gravity in higher dimensions as well. So let me, probably almost all of you know what Virasoro blocks are, but I'm going to say it anyway. And I'll state it in a way which sort of naturally generalizes to higher dimensions. All right, so let's talk about, let me just tell you what Virasoro blocks are. And I'm going to focus on, in particular, one specific Virasoro block, which we call the vacuum block. All right, and this is the particular Virasoro block that has the vacuum state in it, which corresponds to the identity operator. And so what do I mean by that? If you look at an operator with itself, if you take its operator product with itself, that operator product always contains the identity operator that just controls the norm of that operator. And then you also, in 2D, the conformal algebra relates that to an infinite number of other operators, which I'm going to write schematically as t to the n. Okay. Now, if you use this inside a four-point function of two operators OA and two operators OB, and you apply the operator product expansion and look at this particular contribution, then again, there's the contribution from the identity. Then you also get the contribution from a single T, and I'm going to write it in terms of the global conformal blocks. So these are the OP coefficients for two A's to produce a T and two B's to produce a T times the global conformal block for a single stress tensor. And these, of course, are controlled by the word identity. So we know what these are just from the word identity. And then there's an infinite number of other contributions, which I'll write like this. The OP coefficient for two A's to produce T squared, two B's to produce T squared, and then the global conformal block for that guy. And then so on. All right, and this, the entire resummation of this for all arbitrarily many products of stress tensors, this is one way of saying what the Virasoro vacuum block is. Okay, and in 2D, it's clear that you can compute it because all these OP coefficients are completely determined by Virasoro symmetry. Okay. All right. So this is a nice thing to study in two dimensions. It's nice because it's an irreducible representation of the algebra, and so it's the thing you should be using when you do, say, bootstrap for the four-point function in two dimensions. This plus all the other Virasoro blocks for all of the primaries in the theory. But it's also interesting from the point of view of ADS3 gravity. And one way of saying why it's interesting is it's just a universal contribution to this four-point function, so it's always there. Now, if that were the best you could say, maybe it'd be worth studying just as a universal contribution. But you can say more than that, which is that it's actually a universal contribution which knows a lot about gravity in ADS3. All right? And so it's a particularly interesting universal contribution. And the reason for this is really quite simple. It has to do with the general fact in any dimension that in CFT, if you look at the operators, what I'm calling these T to the N operators, just products of the stress tensor, then those are dual on the gravitational side to multi-graviton states. Right? So the fact that this is resumming up all exchange of arbitrary numbers of stress tensors means that when you look at this particular block, you're understanding on the gravity side the contribution from the exchange of arbitrarily many multi-graviton states, which is another way of saying that this block knows about classical GR in ADS3. Okay, and it actually knows about semi-classical GR. There's some various quantum effects that it's sensitive to. So the particular case in which we spend most of our time studying this is what we call the heavy light limit, where two of these guys have a small scaling dimension and two of them have a large scaling dimension. So let me just remind you what the heavy light limit is. So that's the case where we look at O light, O heavy. And the point is the scaling dimension of the light guy is order one. The scaling dimension of heavy guy is order central charge in the limit that the central charge is much greater than one. All right? And this has a nice gravitational interpretation. You can think of the two heavy operators as creating a black hole background. More precisely, they make a microstate for some black hole. And the two light operators are probes in this background. Right? So this four-point function, this heavy light four-point function, the way you should think of it is you're looking at this in the background of the heavy state, which creates a black hole. Here's the black hole horizon. And then in that background, these two light operators are just some probes. And we can use that to probe what's going on in the background of a black hole. And this includes various classical and semi-classical effects in gravity. So just a handful of things which this knows about gravity in ADS3. Perhaps most interestingly, you just by studying this heavy light correlator, you can see black hole thermalization. You can see the heavy states look like they create a thermal background. And in particular, you can see as a result of that, that there's information loss in perturbation theory in 1 over the central charge, which corresponds to perturbation theory in Newton's constant in the bulk. You can see various other things. You can, just from studying this Virasoro block, you can see the Ryu Takanagi formula in ADS3 CFT2. You can also see that gravity saturates the chaos bound on the Lyapunov exponent. And what I personally think is most interesting, you could even see, because this is well defined at any value of the central charge, not just in a 1 over C expansion, you can see that certain violations of unitarity in perturbative gravity get resolved by non-perturbative effects in 1 over the central charge. So, you know, studying this in ADS3 CFT2, I think, has taught us a lot about gravity and how that relates to 2D conformal theories and how we can go beyond perturbative calculations on the gravity side using conformal theories. But today I want to talk about trying to generalize this to higher dimensions. Okay? Now, I've stated this in such a way that this definition immediately can be made in any dimension. Right? So in any dimension, I can say I'm looking at a four-point function of two light and two heavy operators. And by the quote-unquote Virasoro vacuum block in higher dimensions, I just mean I want to look at the contribution from the exchange of all products of stress tensors. Okay, from all operators made from products of stress tensors. All right? So that's what I that's one generalization. I think it's a very natural generalization of Virasoro to higher dimensions, and that's the thing that we're going to study. Okay, so that definition needs to be clarified. If we just apply it in a generic CFT, then you immediately run into an ambiguity, which is, what do we even mean by products of the stress tensor? So a single stress tensor is, of course, well-defined, but if you look at even a product of two of them, when you define this composite operator, you have to bring the two stress tensors on top of each other, and that has singularities that have to be subtracted out, and so you have to say how you're going to subtract those out. And the way I'm going to deal with that is I'm going to take the limit where the central charge of the theory goes to infinity, and I'm only going to be studying this limit. Okay. And in this limit, the correlators of the stress tensors, so TTT correlators, any number of them are described by a generalized free field theory, and there's some canonical definition of what products of operators are in generalized free field theories. All right, and that's the definition that I mean. So that's easy to deal with, and not only a large central charge, but I think perturbatively 1 over the central charge, this definition should work. A bigger issue is that why is this something that that isn't just extremely model dependent? Okay? And that's what the universality in the title is going to refer to. But what I mean by that is, you know, in 2D, all of these OP coefficients for T to the N operators were completely fixed by Virasoro. That's obviously not true in higher dimensions. So in higher dimensions, we have a question. In higher dimensions, we have a question of what are these OP coefficients? Yes.
Bah.
That one works.
I think I have the same confusion that I had in such a talk. So the central charge is large. And
yes.
Then these T's become a border of the central charge. That's the idea.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So this is not describing graviton scattering.
This for yeah the four the endpoint function of T's. So I'm going to be normalizing them like this compared to what you're used to, so that the TT two-point function is order one. And in that limit, the endpoint function of stress tensors is just factorizes into a product of two-point functions.
Right. And
so
what
there's
is
no
the
scattering in that case, yeah.
Right. But what is the picture holographically?
The picture holographically if all you have is stress tensor in the correlator, then nothing happens. All right. So you'd have something like, you know, you had maybe something like this, but if you had T T, T. This is the Witten diagram that you would write down, and you would never have any interactions. Right? All you have is free propagation of the stress tensors. Okay, so at this point, if all you look at is correlators of only stress tensors and nothing else, then it's very boring, and there's nothing ever happens.
So in the next term of the in the central charge expansion, they would start it would start being connected.
That's right.
So that's where the amplitude. So this is like the disconnected part of the scattering amplitude
exactly
of the graviton.
Right. That's right. That's right.
Ah, okay.
That's right. Thank you. Okay. So the reason why I'm going to get non-trivial correlators, which are not just the disconnected piece, is because I'm going to be looking at their contribution to heavy light correlators. And so so here in particular, I mean, what are the T to the NOP coefficients in this heavy light correlation function? And now, let's just talk about, for instance, this contains the contribution from a single stress tensor. This contains CLL stress tensor, C heavy, heavy stress tensor times GT. Okay. And the product of these two guys goes like delta light, delta heavy over CT. And because this heavy dimension operator grows like the central charge, it gives a finite contribution, a non-zero contribution, even at infinite central charge. So in order to get something non-trivial, you have to have a heavy background around to compensate for the... So it's like the fact that in our world, G Newton is really tiny and gravity is really small, and so in particle physics, we never see it, but in our daily lives, we see it all the time because there's a gigantic planet right beneath us. Right? So, all right. So this is the first of an infinite number of OP coefficients that we're going to be looking at. All right. So I think, you know, if you just start asking about this guy, the first thing you would worry about is maybe these OP coefficients, which were so nicely constrained in two dimensions by Virasoro, maybe in higher dimensions, they can just be anything. And there's nothing you can ever say on general grounds. So the question is, are these OPE coefficients? By which I mean, you know, the generalization of this product for any number of stress tensors. Are they completely unconstrained? Right. So obviously, the first one for a single stress tensor is totally controlled by the Ward identity in any dimensions. But in for a T squared, it's not clear that there's any kind of rule. All right, and so the reason we're going to use holography is because we're basically the strategy is we're going to use ADS as a kind of lab to look for universal behavior. All right. So I like to think of ADS CFT, at least from the direction from ADS to CFT side, as basically being like a machine, like a CFT generating machine. Okay? So you know, you stick in a Lagrangian and then you turn the ADS CFT crank and out spits a bunch of CFT correlation functions. And this machine is very useful because while it's hard to construct CFT data starting in D dimensions. You have to find CFTs such that the beta function is zero. In ADS, it's very easy. You just write down whatever Lagrangian you want, and then for every interaction you have a free parameter, and so you get to scan over a large space of CFTs very easily. Okay, and it's very much like what we do in just S matrices and Lagrangians in flat space. You want to explore what kind of S matrices you can get. You write down a flat space Lagrangian. You turn the crank, and you get scattering amplitudes, right? Moreover, you know, if you take an effective field theory perspective, you could, if you were sufficiently powerful, you could explore the possible behavior of all CFTs. The idea would be you write down the most general possible gravity action, and you know, you really have to be very general if you want to make a general statement of CFTs, so you have to allow all possible combinations of fields in the bulk and all possible interactions, but if you did that, then anything you derive would be a general statement about CFTs. And so in that way, it's both conceptually and practically very much like effective field theory in other contexts, like effective field theory for pions, right? You can work very hard and use current algebras to derive relations between pion scattering amplitudes, but it's often much easier to just write down the most general pion Lagrangian consistent with symmetries. And moreover, it makes it easier by writing down the effective Lagrangian, it's easier to put in additional dynamical assumptions. So that's basically what we're going to be doing. We're going to be writing down an effective action on the gravity side. If we were infinitely powerful, as I said, we would write down all possible fields in the bulk, any number of matter fields and gauge fields, and all possible interactions between them. This would include horrible things like Vasiliev theories. We're not infinitely powerful, so we're going to make, so that's way too hard, and instead we're going to make a restriction to the following class of Lagrangians, where we only have the metric and a single scalar field, but we allow ourselves all possible higher curvature terms. Okay, the action is allowed to contain anything that can be made from products of the Riemann tensor, and then we also have the scalar field itself, okay, minimally coupled to gravity. All right. And then this is the class of theories we're going to be studying. So so I just want to make a comment about how general you should expect this class to be. Obviously, it's not completely general. So how general is it? Is this very special that we've only taken these two fields and insisted there's nothing else, or is it relatively general? So the way to think about this is imagine that we had a bunch of other fields. Okay, and imagine that, so we had a bunch of extra matter fields, say, and imagine that all of their masses were controlled by some parameter, which I'll call M, and, you know, here I'm thinking of something like the Etouft coupling, where if you take this thing to be large, the other fields become heavy, okay? So obviously, in the limit where this becomes infinite, all these higher curvature things have to be suppressed by infinity, and so we would just get back Einstein gravity. So what we're doing is more general than that. We're allowing these guys here with arbitrary coefficients, and the way to think about that is if you look at the limit where M is large, you can do an expansion. You could expand in powers of 1 over m. And then all 1 over m to the n fx can be absorbed into irrelevant operators of the kind we're allowing. All right. So therefore, we're going to derive a bunch of results in this context. Any corrections to it would have to be invisible to all orders in 1 over m perturbation theory. So any corrections would have to be non-perturbatively suppressed. Should be something like e to the minus m, or maybe not there at all. Certainly, if you allow additional massless fields, there will be corrections. But the exact dependence on the mass, I don't know. But this argument tells you that they have to be invisible in perturbation theory, whatever. All right? So good. So I think it'd be interesting to include the light fields that are present in a specific model. So to make connection with n equals 4 super Yang Mills, to add in the additional massless fields, and then redo what I'm about to say, and then see how they affect it. But the heavy fields, the ones that can be dialed to be large, should give exponentially suppressed contributions. All right. So good. So that is the context that we're looking at. Now, what is the conclusion? So let me just tell you first what we compute, what we learn, and then I'll tell you increasing amounts of information until we're all very tired, and then we go eat lunch. All right. So what's the basic idea? How do we learn about these OP coefficients? My basic idea is very simple. We're just going to compute the two-point function of the light operator in a black hole background, where the exact black hole metric depends on what all the higher curvature terms are. But that's a computation. It's not so easy, but it's possible. And you can, as I said, you can think of the black hole background as being created by a heavy operator. And so then we interpret that as a light-light heavy-heavy operator, correlation function. And then we do a conformal block decomposition. And we see that this contains contributions from the following two types of operators. It contains contributions from multi-stress tensors, those operators from products of stress tensors, times, so there's the OPE coefficient, times the conformal block for those guys. And this combination I'm going to call P T to the N. And then we also have another kind of operator, which are usually called the double traces. And these have their own OP coefficients, C heavy heavy, O light squared times G O light squared, C Z bar. And there's an infinite number of double trace operators that can be made basically from two copies of the light operator and any number of derivatives, all right? Okay. So you compute this, you do the conformal block decomposition, you look at what you find for the OP coefficients of the multi-stress tensor operators. And what you find is, in general, most of the multi-stress tensor operators have OP coefficients that depend on all of the higher curvature terms and are not universal. But there's a special class of them, which is insensitive to higher curvature terms. So in D greater than 2, the punchline is that the OP coefficients P T to the N for the products of stress tensors with the lowest possible twist at each N are universal. Okay? And by that I mean they depend only on the dimension of the light operator and the following combination that I'll call F0, which is the heavy operator divided by the central charge. This is still at CT goes to infinity. All right? Yeah, Matthias?
For large N, it appears to be of many different operators, Tn, right?
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's right. So there, good. Thank you for asking. There are, at any N, there are an infinite number of operators with the lowest value of twist for that N, right? And they all depend only on delta L and F0. Okay. So let me basically just spell this out in a little more detail. So these are, really these are functions of n and the spin. So this is f0 to the n for t to the n operator with spin j. It's a function of n and j, and depends on delta l. Okay, so let me just write out these operators a little schematically, but in more detail than I have so far. So n equals 1, there's only one guy. It's the strength tensor. That's the only operator. What about n equals 2? So there are, if I don't use derivatives, there are the following operators, t mu nu, t rho sigma, t mu nu, t nu sigma, where I contract one index, and t mu nu, where I contract two indices. And j in this case is equal to, here it's 4, here it's 2, and here it's 0. And so the twist, which is equal to the dimension minus the spin, is equal to, here it's, so the stress tensor has dimension d, so this is 2d minus 4, here it's 2d minus 2, and here it's 2d. And so this guy is an example of a lowest twist. All right. And as Matthias was asking about, there also you can make, starting with that guy, you can also make an infinite number of other guys with lowest twist. So there's also t mu nu, and then schematically something like d sigma, d rho, d lambda, etc., times t alpha beta. And the point is, adding derivatives without contracting indices raises the dimension and it raises the spin, but it doesn't raise the twist. All right, so there's an infinite number of at each end, there's an infinite number of lowest twist guys. The lowest twist at each number of stress tensors, you can easily see that it's just n times d minus 2. Okay. All right. All right, so this is the main punchline, is that there's an infinite set of these guys which is insensitive to higher curvature terms. All right. And so there's some universal contribution to heavy light correlators. Yeah. If you contract the derivatives, then you lower the spin, so you raise the twist. So you're no longer lowest twist. That's right. There certainly are such operators, but they have higher than minimum twist. Okay? All right. So I'll say this again, but let me just mention what's interesting about lowest twist is these are the guys that dominate near the light cone. So essentially, there's some universal contribution from the stress tensors that dominate as you take the two light probe operators close to each other. All right. So let me just briefly say a little bit about how we do the computation in practice. I'm not going to go through the gory details, but I just want you to at least have a sense of what is involved. So the way you compute these guys, so I said we compute the two-point function of the light operator in the black hole background. How do you do that? So we're looking at the background created by the heavy state operator. So first of all, this guy is, we assume it's a scalar. So that implies that the metric is spherically symmetric. We assume that it's a primary. That implies that the metric is stationary. And so the metric has to take the form ds squared is equal to 1 plus r squared, and then there's some function, which is sometimes called an emblackening factor. And then there's another function in the r squared piece. And then that's it. Okay? And then furthermore, the theory is conformal, so the background has to be asymptotically ADS. So that tells us in a large R expansion, these functions, their leading term is 1 over the ADS radius squared. The first correction is some coefficient divided by R to the D. And this F0 is the same as this, times some factors of pi and 2, which I'm not going to write down. And then there are higher order things. So for example, there can be something like this. And similarly for H of R. The leading term is 1 over L ADS squared minus H0 of RD minus dot, dot, dot. All right? And then it's a matter of solving for the bulk to boundary propagator phi so we solve the equation of motion, which is just box plus m squared phi is equal to 0. And we solve for it in a 1 over r expansion. And each order, higher and higher orders in 1 over r, only get contributions from OP coefficients at so there's a relation between orders in 1 over r and orders in the operator product expansion. So if you want to compute the OP coefficients to some order in the OPE, then you only need to solve this to some order in 1 over r. Okay? And that's difficult, but it can be done. And so that's what most of the work is, actually, is solving this in 1 over r expansion. So you work hard and you do that, and then you get the bulk to boundary propagator. And once you have the bulk to boundary propagator, then extracting the two-point function in the black hole background is totally trivial. By the standard CFT dictionary, then O light is equal to the limit, R goes to infinity, R to the delta light times phi, which depends on the boundary coordinates as well as the bulk radial coordinate. Right? And then you have this, and then you can go off and do a conformal block decomposition. Yeah. Good. Thank you. So I didn't say anything about this because it's actually easier to discuss now after I told you it's a large radius expansion. So you. So I said that phi was minimally coupled to gravity, but you can also allow curvature terms with phi itself. The most general thing that you can have, you can write in the following way, g alpha 1, g beta 1, dot, 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 some number of these guys. And then you also have derivatives acting on phi. Okay, and I guess you can also have the Riemann tensor, sigma rho. So combinations of these things. And the point is the lowest twist guys are going to only depend on the first term in this large R expansion. So they only depend on the metric, the leading piece at large R, which is just ADS. So all these guys, the Riemann tensors in ADS, they're just proportional to the metric. And so now you can collapse all this down. So this collapses to phi box to the S phi. And then you can use the equations of motion to reduce this to m to the 2s phi. So if you add a term, if you generate a term like this, then that's equivalent to just renormalizing the mass to a mass plus alpha m to the 2s. So it can be completely absorbed into a shift in the mass. But yes, thank you for asking. That's a great question. Okay. All right. So I started off by saying we only allow higher curvature terms, but we can also allow any higher curvature terms with the coupling to phi as well. Okay. All right. Good. And that's specifically because the lowest twist guys are only going to be sensitive to the leading piece at large R. And in fact, that's really all that goes into the that's almost all that goes into the universality of the lowest twist guys, is that if you massage the bulk to boundary propagator equation of motion, you can see that the OP coefficients for lowest twist all come from the leading large R piece, and so that's why they're only sensitive to F0. And this guy is fixed because that's the coefficient of the stress tensor is totally fixed by the Ward identities. The story is a little bit more complicated than that, because all I've told you is that a statement about the equations of motion for the bulk to boundary propagator, but there are also two boundary conditions. To get phi, you also have to impose boundary conditions. And there's one boundary condition that is imposed at the boundary of ADS, and there's another boundary condition that's imposed at the horizon. Okay, so the boundary condition at the boundary of ADS is obviously fine. That also is, that's just the first term in the large R expansion. But the boundary condition at the horizon is less obviously innocent, and that definitely depends on the details of all of these guys. And there's sort of a surprise, which is when you impose that, you find that the T to the N OP coefficients do not depend on the boundary condition at the horizon. All right? So the solution has to depend on the horizon somehow, and that dependence completely comes in through the double trace, what I call the OLs, OL squareds, OP coefficients. And these guys do depend on the boundary condition at the horizon. All right? Now, to state this in a little more physical terms, what this says is if you're looking at the background of some state and you want to know if it's a black hole state or a microstate, then that difference is entirely encoded at a large central charge in the OP coefficients of the double trace operators, right? Because they are the only ones who know whether there's really a horizon there or whether you were just looking at a local operator in the bulk. So let me spell that out a little more clearly. But the punchline is that the double trace OP coefficients encode whether the bulk is a black hole versus it's created by a local bulk operator. All right, so imagine instead of doing the computation I've described, where we have a black hole in the bulk, imagine I did something instead where I just put a local bulk operator. That will not have a horizon, it'll have some Compton wavelength, which so its distribution gets smoothed out. And this, since it's a black hole, it corresponds to, maybe this is too low, this corresponds to the canonical ensemble. Whereas this guy is a specific microstate. All right? So if you ever wanted to know how does the CFT distinguish between large central charge between a black hole and a microstate, the OP coefficients of products of stress tensors are totally insensitive to this distinction. It's completely encoded in the OP coefficients of double trace operators. Okay. So somehow the double trace operators are the guys who know about the horizon and whether you're looking at a microstate or an ensemble. All right. So let's see. How much more time do I have? 15? Okay, great. So One of the, let me talk a little bit more where these operators dominate and what regions are, what region of the 4-point function is controlled by them. So I want to make the following point, which is we actually have a way to connect this to the iconal limit and shockwaves. So I'll say this so again, but there's another limit which is in gravity, which is known to be universal in the sense that it's insensitive to Hilbert curvature terms, and that's if you look at shockwave solutions. So what is the relation between these lowest twist operators and the shockwaves? And this is in some ways an application in a different context to of a paper that Miguel, James Drummond, Vasco, and Joao wrote in 2013, where they were looking at single trace operators rather than multi trace operators. But the idea is basically the same. So what is the idea? The point is, when we take the lowest twist limit, basically we're looking near the light cone. All right, and so in Z, in the bootstrap ZZ bar variables, what that means is we're taking Z bar goes to zero, but Z can be anything, okay? All right, so if we look at where these two light operators are, the first light operator has some light cone, and we're taking the second light operator very close. So Z bar is controlling the distance away from the light cone, so Z bar has to stay small. But Z is controlling where we are along the light cone. And so we're free to move Z to be anything, right? Because once we take Z bar small, the lowest twist guys dominates, we still can take Z to be whatever we want, and that allows us enough freedom to explore some interesting regimes of the correlation function. Okay, so let me tell you this is a nice formula by, I believe, due to Dolan and Osborne, which is the global conformal blocks near the light cone. They take this very simple form in terms of the twist and the spin. They're just approximately equal to Z bar to the tau over 2 times a hypergeometric function, which I'm going to call f tau over 2 plus j of z. And what I mean by this is f a of z is defined as z to the a to f 1 a 2 a z. Okay? All right, so let's look at the case d equals 4 and 4. Now I'm going to focus on d equals 4 for the rest of the talk. So let's do an expansion in all these lowest twist operators. We have zz bar to the delta L times O light, O heavy at Z bar is much less than 1. This contains, so the first lowest twist guy is the identity. The second one is just the stress tensor. Right, and then at order F naught squared, Z bar squared, now we get immediately this infinite sum over all the lowest twist guys that I mentioned before. So we have T squared, but for each J, even J greater than or equal to 4, there is an operator. And so if we want to study, and then the corrections to this go like F0 cubed. Those are the three stress tensors. So if we want to study what happens at order F0 squared, and we want to see what happens in regimes where we take Z to some interesting place, we need to be able to resum this entire infinite set, which means we need to know the infinite set of OP coefficients as a function of J for all the T squared operators, okay? So, fortunately, it's a lot of work, but you can do it, and this is the answer right here. This specific form isn't so important, but what is important is that it's a calculable function. I think in practice, it should be relatively straightforward to do it for t cubed, t to the 4, and so on. It's just going to be more work. It was already a lot of work to get it for t squared, but I don't think there's any fundamental obstacle to getting it for whatever number of t's you want. Okay, so now we know p t squared of j, and so therefore we can resum. And once we resum them, then at small z bar we can look at whatever value of z we want. Okay. So what can we do with that? There are a couple interesting things you can do, but I'm going to focus specifically on the relation between the Iaconal limit and shockwaves with the lowest twist stress tensors. And in order to get to the Iaconal limit, what you do is the following. So O light is at z. You can think of O heavy as being at 1, at the point 1, and then the other O heavy operator is at the point infinity. And the Regi limit, there's a branch cut between these two guys, and the Regi limit is you go around to the second sheet through this branch cut, and then you take z to 0. So z to 0 on second sheet with z over z bar. All right, so this is controlled by shockwave geometry. This was first worked out in a set of beautiful papers by Miguel, Lorenzo, Joao, and Ricardo in 2006. So here, first, because we can resum resum p t squared of j, g, what did I say? F 2 plus j of z, then we can just take this resummation, we can analytically continue it, and we find that in this limit, O light, O heavy, behaves like this. There's some prefactor, and then the coefficient of the leading singularity is fairly simple. And it just looks like this. And then there are higher order terms which are less singular in 1 over z. All right. So you can study this limit by, as I mentioned, by a shockwave computation. This is another regime where we know that the heavy light correlation functions are insensitive to higher curvature terms. So this is controlled by a shockwave geometry. And so in this case, what you're looking at is something like this. You have heavy operators are null separated. They create a background, a shockwave background, which travels on a null surface between them. And then you also have the two light operators are separated by a null geodesic. Miguel and Zhao and their collaborators wrote down a nice integral formula for what this was, and you can evaluate it. So we evaluated the integral to all orders in F0. And what you find is O light, shockwave. I'll just write down the most singular piece. Is a sum of terms of the following form. And the coefficient at each power of F0, which is proportional to Newton's constant, looks like the following. All right, and maybe the specific form isn't that important. If you look at n equals 1, then this just gives you delta L, which is what you know you have to get from the Ward identity. For n equals 2, you can just simplify this, and you get exactly the formula that we got from the analytic continuation of the lowest twist guys. All right. So the result matches. Of course, it had to match, but I think that it's nice that you can actually compute it from these two different sides, and you can see that explicitly that they agree. Now, I'm just going to make basically one last comment, which is, I've been talking about these two different regimes where the physics is insensitive to higher curvature terms. One of them is the shockwave regime, and the other is the lowest twist regime. And what is the connection between them? So Regé theory gives you a very simple relation between them, which is, what the piece that matched between the two of them was this leading 1 over z singularity for n equals 2 is 1 over z to the 4. Leading 1 over z to the 4 singularity. So the qualitative picture I want you to have in mind is that there's some regime which is the Regé limit, which is insensitive to higher curvature terms. There's another limit, which is these lowest twist Thielian operators for any value of z, not necessarily in the Regé limit. And they're both insensitive to higher curvature terms, and they have some overlap. Okay? And that overlap is the Regé limit at lowest twist, where z bar is small. So what does that mean in terms of the OPE data of these coefficients? So here's what these OPE coefficients were for all j. There's some part of this which is controlled by the shockwave behavior. And that piece is the singularity of this as an analytic continuation in j at j equals 3. So this has a pole at j equals 3 coming from this gamma function. And the residue of that pole is the piece which is controlled by both the shockwave limit and by the lowest twist guys. So the j equals 3, so this is controlled by the j equals 3 pole in p t squared of j. And you can look at its residue. And the residue matches 1 and 2 as it has to. 1 is the lowest twist resummation. 2 is the shockwave. And so you're supposed to interpret this as a j equals 3 light ray operator, I guess. I think sort of natural to suspect that this is something like a product of two anek, average null energy condition. So the anek, by the anek I mean the integral over light ray of the minus minus component of the stress tensor. And let me just say one last thing, which supports this, which is you can look at the geodesic limit of the shockwave. All right, so I told you there are these integral expressions which you can evaluate. You can just get the exact answer from the shockwave at any order in 1 over n. Any order in n, any order in f0. And you can take the geodesic limit of that, and what you find is that the light-light heavy-heavy correlator is equal to, schematically, the exponentiation of the Anik. Okay, and by that I mean, by Anik, in quotes here, what I mean is the contribution, so delta H times the contribution, O light, from the Anik operator, Ex minus T minus minus, O light. Okay? So it sort of, I think it looks like this J equals 3 light ray operator, whatever it is, seems like it's makes sense that it's some piece in the product of two Anik. All right, good. That's basically all I wanted to say. So thanks very much for your attention. And yeah, that's all.
I have a very low-level question. You're studying this ADS black hole background. You're saying this background is generated by a CFT state, by an operator OH with some sharp scaling dimension delta H. But naively, you know, I would think that some black hole corresponds to a complicated linear combination of many CFT states. So how precisely are you?
Well, I think at infinite central charge, it should have a well-defined mass, right? Just like it's basically a classical background. So it's just a classical black hole, and all the quantum is coming from the probe operator itself.
Could you comment about is there something of this should be expected for the generic CFT at large spin? Does something sort of like this?
So part of it is, so I can say, I mean, that's a very interesting question. I don't know the full answer. I do know, so this was actually said very clearly in the paper by Andrei Parnichov, that if you take the leading large delta L behavior here of this guy, that part is controlled just by crossing symmetry. So if you look at, if you demand crossing symmetry and the fact that you have the stress tensor in one channel, you see that you have to have contributions which, you basically see that you have to have exponentiation of a single stress tensor in the large delta element. So the subleading pieces, probably are not always always universal in all theories. Yeah, I don't know if I have anything else sharp to say.
Okay. By your skills.
Oh.
Can your statement about universality be rephrased that statement about bulk amplitude involving scalars and gravitons?
Can it be phrased as a statement about what?
About an amplitude bulk amplitude involving scalars and gravitons.
A bulk amplitude, you mean like a scattering amplitude?
Yeah, like with that. You have an OP coefficient like COO and E to the
I think good. At large impact parameter, they should be related to. I'm not sure what the exact statement is, but I think the answer has to be yes.
Probably it may be related to like stop limits or something like that.
I'm not sure if it should be a soft limit because is the, maybe, I mean, yeah, maybe. There's arbitrary number of gravitons, but maybe they're all soft, soft gravitons. Yeah, maybe in the flux space limit, they're still all soft.
More questions? Let's thank Liam for lunch.